Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Susan Kalman, and welcome back to Susan Kalman's Mrs. Brightside. Thanks for downloading the show.
I thought, I'm going to be an influencer. That's what I'll do. I'll be an influencer. And I realised at that point, I'd leant over the table to get the remote control, and I had beans on my boobs. I'd leant into my lunch plate. And I thought, that's why I'm not an influencer.
Well, you could promote beans, couldn't you?
I've got Heinz bean boobs. Heinz bean boobs.
Last year, I spoke to 8 people about their tricksy mental health, and this year, I'll be chatting to 8 more.
I've been in therapy since I was 16, so I'm very into the whole mental health thing. Basically, my brain is a fun place to be.
Yeah, it's a busy old place in there. I'm doing this because I want people to be more open about their mental health, and I know sometimes it can be difficult to define what that means. So we're going to be having a frank and open discussion, no parameters, no written questions, no definitions, and no pop psychology. It's important for you to know that these are not therapy sessions. I am not a qualified psychiatrist, no matter how much Casualty I've watched. They're just honest conversations about what we think and feel about our own heads. This week I spoke to Sophie Hagen, a close friend and someone I admire greatly. We talked about everything from activism to trolls to just how to live life as best as you can.
Is that us? The producer has managed to press a button. Ben, I don't mean to do down what you're doing. That sounded very cruel, didn't it? But you did just literally press a space button on a computer there. That's what you did, wasn't it? He refuses to talk. You know, you listen to these podcasts and the producers join in and stuff.
Yeah.
Not this one, eh? There he is.
It's all giggly. Very giggly, though.
He's very giggly, isn't
he? I don't want people to imagine that he's all, like, cool in the corner being
like James Dean. No, he's just sitting giggling, isn't he? And he's trying to shrink down underneath the table as well at the moment. So, Sophie Hagen.
Hello.
I know you very well.
Yeah.
What I always like to do at the start of this podcast is get people to introduce themselves and say what they think they do so that I'm not saying what I think you do. So please introduce yourself to the tens of hundreds of people listening to this podcast right now.
1,000 people?
1,000 people, yes.
I am a stand-up comedian. I am an author, I guess. There's a book
you
out, so technically
are.
I'm an author. Mm-hmm. And I am, I think, also an activist. And people have been asking me to say designer now because I have a clothing line out.
You did? I saw that. That's amazing.
I don't think I'll ever feel comfortable saying that I'm a designer.
I saw that on Instagram. Was it Instagram?
Yeah,
I was like, oh my God, she's got her own clothing range.
It's the weirdest thing I've ever done. So I'm like, yeah, I'm a designer as well as an activist and an author. But I think comedian
You've
is
You've changed, Sophie.
I know,
knew
right?
you when you were just a stand-up. And listen to you now.
I know.
British people hate people like Sophie, don't they? Hey, I'm a designer and I'm an activist.
I'm a designer and influencer.
Oh my God.
Instagrammer.
Absolutely. I thought.
Guru, fitness guru.
I was like, all the people I was on Strictly with, right, always have things. Like, they're always on Instagram going, oh, look at my new. I thought, why don't I get anything? And I thought, I'm going to be an influencer. That's what I'll do. I'll be an influencer. And I realised at that point, I'd leant over the table to get the remote control and I had beans on my boobs. I'd leant into my lunch plate. And I thought, that's why I'm not an influencer.
Well, you could promote beans, couldn't you?
I've got
Heinz beans.
Heinz bean boobs. I've been on your podcast, Made of Human.
Yeah, you have. Thank you so much for doing it. They were like people's favourite episodes. People keep mentioning them to me.
We managed to talk for about 3 hours, remember? It had to be a two-parter.
Yeah. I think I released the first episode that same evening because I was like, this is incredible. I need it to just be released now because it was so good.
And we have talked previously about mental health and all of that kind of malarkey. I describe myself as someone fortunate enough to have depression, anxiety, control issues, just all the classics.
Yeah.
What's your take on mental health?
So I had depression. I think I've always had anxiety. I don't, you know how you're like, you never really, it's hard to say I don't have depression anymore. I don't see it anymore, but I guess it's probably still there somewhere. But I have anxiety, I have OCD, and I suffer from complex PTSD. And I think it's called secondary trauma. No, it's not. The secondary PTSD, or like complex secondary PTSD, something fun like that, which is also like a Venn diagram between that and then echoism, which is like a very new thing that doesn't really have an official definition yet. But there's like one book written about it, so it's still like a theory. I don't know all the fancy words for it. Basically, my brain is a fun place to be.
Yeah, it's a busy old place in there.
I've been in therapy since I was 16, so I'm very into the whole mental health thing. I'm in an exciting part of my journey now because it's the first time I've had a proper diagnosis. So for all of the therapists I've had before this, none of them could figure out what this was. And I had, you know, one who was just like, I don't know what it is, so let's fix all the other stuff. I was like, fine. I had one who just did not get it. And she kept saying like, it does make sense. Can you draw it? And I was like, no, I've been trying to, you know, I have maybe 500 analogies for this thing that's happening in my head. And it wasn't till this, my last psychologist, the one I'm seeing now, because then the one I had before her would sort of gaslight me about it and be like, well, everyone feels like that. I'm like,
I hate it when that.
The worst. Yeah, I was like, I'm pretty sure they don't, because then why would they be alive? And then this one, my new one, she's a trauma expert. So she was like, oh, I know what this is. And it's sort of complex PTSD. It weirdly sounds like I'm bragging, which I might be. She said, most people who feel like this, like if the way I feel, my condition is constant, and that is very, 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 very abnormal. Most people who suffer from this will have it in like a 3-hour stint or maybe even a week, but then they'll always come back to whatever normal is or healthy or sane or whatever you'd call it. But I am constant. I've been constant in this state of mind for my entire life. She was like, the reason no one's believed you is because when you say that to people, people will always go, yeah, but if that was true, you wouldn't function.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have a job. You wouldn't get out of bed. You wouldn't be alive. So she was like, that's why no one's believed you. And that's why she was like, that's why this sounds so. So she kept asking me about it like again and again and again. I was like, yeah, I'm telling the truth. This is how I feel constantly all the time, from when I wake up till I fall asleep all the time. And she was like, wow, okay. Well, then you don't make sense, because that shouldn't be possible for you to basically exist.
I think, though, that's why people don't think I'm telling the truth about my anxiety, especially when it comes to travelling places or my anxiety about needing to know where I'm going all the time. Ben, the producer here, bless him. I mean, last night I was emailing because I didn't necessarily believe that today was happening. And I need someone to email me and say, no, today is happening.
Yeah, you mean like
and
the,
what
your
time
schedule?
Is it happening? Yeah. And what, you know. And I tried to explain it to someone once and they said, that can't be true. I said, no, I live in this state of anxiety the whole time. And that's my normal. My normal is living here on the ceiling.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's like to not live like that.
Well, I've had, so my echoism is sort of, so I was about to ask you if it's okay if this gets dark, but I imagine.
Sure. Yeah. It's absolutely fine, Sophie. Go as dark
as you
want.
So because of some childhood trauma, tiny little child me very, very quickly learned to shut off all emotions, like just to basically not exist, because to exist was unsafe, because the adults couldn't be trusted and were horrible. I had a very abusive, horrible grandfather. So I just went into this state of not existing, like not, like if I would draw myself, I'd just make like a doodle, almost like a ghost, like I'm not there, but all the other people were real people with arms and legs and stuff, where I was just like not even present in my own drawings and stuff. So I was just like not there. And that's kind of how I've been my entire life. Like I'm never present. But five times I've become present. And this must sound, well, I know it sounds weird because so far only one therapist I've met who understands this. But basically I've had 5 instances where I suddenly snapped back into reality, where I like suddenly felt like, oh my god, now I know, I remember my memories, I know what I like, Like, if you know, when you ask someone, what's your favourite colour, or what's your favourite memory from last Edinburgh, or what's the best thing that's ever happened, what's your favourite Christmas? You know, it's just like random stuff like that. Most people will be able to like go into their brains and go, right, oh, what's my favourite Christmas? Or, oh, I think my favourite colour is purple, or what do I feel like eating? I feel like, spaghetti, or whatever. I don't have that. So if you ask me, what's your favourite colour, I just go, duh. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing, because I don't exist. But five times in my life, I've snapped into it and suddenly felt like, oh my God, I feel my body. I know what I want to eat, you know, and the anxiety went away, the OCD went away, the depression went away, because I was suddenly like alive and feeling my feelings. Mm-hmm. So I know what it's like to live like that, but I just don't, because there were very short periods of time. Like
What triggered you coming back into reality?
Extreme feelings. So one was a breakup where I just came completely out of the blue and I was like just crying on his floor for 24 hours. I couldn't leave his flat. I basically took him hostage. I was just like, this can't be real. Mm-hmm. Self-harm, the first time was when I was 16. I self-harmed and suddenly this sounds horrible, but if you have self-harmed, you'll understand. It felt amazing. Of course, it's not a solution and no one should do it because it's dangerous and stuff. But and then it was reading a self-help book that when I was 18, I was so I was so happy. I broke up with my boyfriend. We were on holiday, 5 days into a 10-day holiday in London, and I was like, "I'm breaking up with you. I'm going to go out and buy a dress. Goodbye." Mm-hmm. And he was like crying in bed, but I was so happy because I was breathing for the first time in my life. And then it was like once for a few hours because a therapist said to me, I was told her my whole life story, and she went, "Oh, that must have been hard." And it was almost like, "Gdush."
Yeah.
So all these different scenarios of really extreme emotions, but I live on a day-to-day basis of I don't really exist. Like, like getting out of bed is so difficult. It is so difficult because I'm not really there, basically.
There was something I didn't know about you, and you can tell me if you don't want to talk about this at all. I think it was on a Facebook update or something. You were saying about, I've seen you sometimes put, does anyone want this cabinet?
Yeah.
And I've always gone, gosh, she's got a lot of furniture, hasn't she? And that's not actually what it is. No. But I didn't know this about you, that you sometimes have to get things out of your house.
Well, it's my OCD, so it's two things. I didn't know I had OCD before I just casually told my therapist about my couch. Because I woke up one morning and I was like, the couch is just a bit big, isn't it? I'd have more space if I didn't have the couch. Maybe I should get rid of it. Maybe I should put it on Gumtree or whatever. And that was like at 10 a.m. in the morning. By 10 p.m., I was sitting on my bed, like nails into my thighs, just like, get the couch out of my house. And I was calling all these, you know, men with a van at like 1 a.m., just going, can you please, please come and get the couch out of my house, because I will die if it doesn't leave my house. Mm-hmm. And they were like, no, it's 1 a.m., I can't. But they were like, we can come at 6 a.m. tomorrow. I was like, no, it has to be now. Ended up calling a friend, and I was like, I know you have like a wife and kids and a real life, and I know it's 1 a.m., but could you by any chance come to my flat and carry a couch out onto the street? And he did. I still don't know why, but he did. And then I could breathe again. I was like, oh, God, I'm a whew. And that happens sometimes. 3 weeks ago, it was a chest of drawers that suddenly had to go. And I got some stranger from Facebook Marketplace to come and to carry it out. And I was like, thank you so much, thank you so much, thank you so much. He was like, no, you're giving me free furniture. Like, I mm-hmm. should give you something. I was like, no, please just get
it out. Just take it out. Yeah.
And then, of course, I had to get a new chest of drawers, like, really quickly, because I needed.
And can you in any way, and I'm not asking you, if you can, it's not a problem, because the irrational part of our brain, I think the irrational part of my brain is the most fascinating part. I'm a hugely rational human being the majority of the time, but the irrational part of my brain is the bit I have no idea what the hell is going on. And I will irrationally, my washing machine is leaking, Sophie. And I can't stop thinking about that washing machine. And I want that washing machine fixed.
Yeah.
And my wife keeps saying, I'll get a plumber. And she doesn't understand, I can't sleep because of that washing machine.
I totally relate
just
to that.
Yeah. Can we get the washing machine fixed?
Yeah.
So the irrational part of my brain is quite interesting. When you look at that, what it's difficult to try and describe. When you see the sofa or the chest of drawers and you want it out, is there a fear? Is there a panic? What's happening in your head?
Yeah, it's panic. It's full. It's so overwhelming. It's like it takes up all the space in my head, in my life. It is everything. It becomes everything. And it's not sofa size. It's not chest of drawer size. It is the whole, it takes up the whole room. And there's not, there's nothing but the chest of drawers in the room. And I can't breathe because I'm basically lying underneath a huge chest of drawers and I can't get out. Mm-hmm. That is how desperate it is. And I, you know, I just cannot, yeah, I can't breathe. It feels like I can't psychologically breathe without the piece of furniture gone. It could also just be moving things around in my room or reorganizing the, like if I get it into my head, I need to reorganize the cupboard. That's just what I have to do. Then I have to just immediately get a lot of, I mean, storage things, like one of the biggest things I need, you know, if there's too much in a drawer, huh, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. And also I can't handle anything being in a drawer where it doesn't make sense. Like it has to be, it all has to make some kind of sense. And it's, I mean, I know what it is. It's definitely just a fleeing from emotions because all emotions are scary, which is what I learned when I was a child, that feelings are really, really frightening and you should feel ashamed and you should feel guilty and they're dangerous and you can hurt people if you express your feelings and everyone will be very mad at you or very sad if you express any kind of emotion. So they're so far away. So it's fear, that anxiety and fear is, you know, that's what feels so big that I can't breathe. It's actually because I'm, a part of me is super, super scared and sad all the time, which then becomes a chest of drawers.
One of the things that I know, so after writing Cheer Up Love about depression, I realised it's really tiring being this anxious. Oh, that's one of the things that people don't realise. They think there is a certain amount of wallowing in depression. I'll be honest, sometimes it's quite good. But it's, Jesus, it's tiring. It really is tiring. Living. And my therapist said to me, I'm essentially like an SAS commando. Emotionally, I'm ready to run or fight anytime you like. I am always waiting for the next thing. That's tiring. To live in a constant state of alert all the time, isn't it? I have no capacity to relax.
Mm. Oh yeah, no, that's,
can't relax.
I don't think that's ever happened.
I can't honestly remember. My wife can sit on that sofa for 12 hours a day, and I'll say to her, "What are you thinking about?" And she says nothing, and she genuinely means it. I have never sat in my life and thought about nothing.
Yeah, no,
I'm always thinking about something.
Oh yeah, there's always dangers out there. Well, my therapist explained trauma to me in such a nice, comfortable way. Have you seen that YouTube video? There's like a lizard and then it gets chased.
Yes.
And then once it realizes it's safe, it like shakes, like its whole body just shakes. And then it just walks away. And she was like, that is what you do. You know, you'll go around a corner and your friend will be like, boo. And then your whole body goes, mm-hmm. I'm going to die now. I'm going to die. And then you go, No, it's okay, it's your friend. You're not in any danger, everything's fine. And then you go, oh, and you kind of shake it off and then you're fine. Trauma is when you go, boom, and then nothing. And then you have that, oh, I'm going to die. And it's just in your body. So I'm seeing two therapists at the moment. I'm seeing this trauma expert who's like trauma brain stuff, talking therapy, I think it's called. And then I have a body therapist where I'm not really allowed to talk, which is horrible.
You're not...
I'm not allowed to talk. It's just horrible. It's horrible. So she's a body trauma therapist. She's very expensive. I can only see her like once a month. And she's like... So what she does is... Well, she hasn't done it yet because I'm incapable of doing it yet. But she goes, right, feel your body. Try and be present in your body. You know, can you feel your knees? Feel your breathing. She's like, where are you tense? I'm like, I'm not tense. She's like, where are you tense? I'm like, oh, my stomach. Okay. Where are you tense now? I'm not oh, my legs. Okay. So I'm always have like a tension somewhere. And then like when you're in your body, she'll go, now how did it feel like when your grandfather did that? And then you have to, that feeling will come back into you and then you have to feel it through. So with every trauma you have in your life, you have to go back to the moment when you were like, I'm going to die.
Oh, wow.
And then you have to go, it's okay, we're safe, everything's fine. And then you shake it off. But you have to do that with like all the trauma. So I've yet to go to her where I hadn't just shut down beforehand because I just can't.
I'll be honest, that sounds absolutely terrifying.
It's the worst thing. It's the worst thing I've ever had to do. It is so frightening and I hate it. I hate it. And I've had all these irrational things about her where I've like, oh no, I hate her. She's just a horrible person. But she's not. It's just my brain going, yeah, no, we really don't want to do this.
Your book,
because you are an author, a designer. An
author, designer, oh,
influencer,
activist, comedian.
Absolutely. You're everything to everyone, Sophie. I know what it's about. It's a great book. Why did you write it? Instead of what's it about, why did you write it?
I wrote the book, Happy Fat, because, I mean, I've always written. I wrote before I did anything else. And I've accumulated so much knowledge and opinions and resources and about fatness. And I would so often get asked by people after my show or people on the internet, like all the time people would ask the same kind of questions of, why do you call yourself fat? Or how do I learn to love my body? Or, but isn't it unhealthy? Or, you know, it's the same questions every single time. And for a while I was like, yeah, but I can't say much new because these questions have all been answered since the early 1970s. But still, there were still so many people who were never going to read those books. And I was like, I have a fairly big audience compared to most people. So maybe I should just like write it. And then I thought it was going to be really serious, but then I was so fortunate that it became funny as well, which it would have been horrible if it had just been serious and dark. But then I was like, okay, well, I think I'm the only comedian who knows all this stuff about fatness. So maybe there is something that I can contribute with.
Of all the things that I get on social media, of which I get many, many things, how I look is the major thing that people will immediately go to. The things I hate most of all is people say, you look like. When everyone says, you look like, they'll put a picture of someone and it's not a flattering thing.
No.
It's never a flattering thing.
No.
Lol. And you go, that's not very good at all.
It's not that funny, no.
And it really, it's very difficult to explain to people. I did a show, I never watch myself on television because I can't watch myself. But how we look is of interest to everybody, according to them, is it not?
It's the go-to, women are taught to that their value is in the way they look. So that is the first place they will go to make you sad. That's the one thing where they're like, haha, if you're ugly, then there's no reason for you to even exist. Because a fat person or an unattractive person can't attract a man. And if you can't attract a man, then you are worthless. What is your point? Why are you on earth? You know? So they'll be like, I wouldn't fuck you. And you're like, who? And you look at their profile. They're like a 21-year-old from Michigan. You're like, no. I mean, even if you did want to, it probably wouldn't happen.
But you wouldn't have a say in it, though. The point is that we don't have a say in it.
No, not at all.
They can express our attractiveness without us asking.
Yeah.
I literally don't need to know whether or not I'm fuckable, according to anyone who's watched any programmes I've ever done. That is not... When I'm standing there attempting to present a show about Scotland or dancing on Strictly, I am not thinking, God, I hope people are aroused by what's happening here. That's not what I'm thinking about.
I really couldn't care less. I really couldn't care less. I did this thing yesterday, which is another kind of semi-obsessive thing, compulsive thing. I couldn't sleep because of it. Where I, some guy put a emoji that throws up under one of my pictures, which is like a common, it's like the most lazy trolling, but they do that sometimes. And I think that, I think that's worse than words sometimes. I'm like, that's really annoying. So I looked in his profile, and then I looked at his profile for an hour. His profile, mm-hmm. his mother's profile, his brother's profile. He's a kid from, not even a kid, like a young adult from Michigan. And I just looked through his whole life and went back through his timeline. And he was fairly happy 2 years ago. He seemed to have like a lot of friends. All of his posts got like comments and stuff. And then like there was like a tragedy that happened on his street. He saw something quite traumatic. He lost his dog that he'd had for 10 years. I mean, I was crying in bed looking at his posts about this dog because it was so sad. You know, he got a new dog, but she wasn't really, you know, getting along with his mother. And, you know, his mother was a bit of a bigot, but like not really. She had a lot of thoughts about transgender people, but they were actually like, oh, I don't mind people having I don't actually mind that people are whatever gender they say they are. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, I just wish they wouldn't wear pink lipstick because that doesn't suit anyone. You're like, right. Oh, she's what a strange character. His brother looks really happy, travels a lot, has this amazing girlfriend, and just has a lot of comments under his. I went full into this guy's post and his, and then there was a photo he put up where he put unflattering photo of himself. He was he's fat himself, and then his mother wrote, "This is not good," like as a comment, and he wrote, "I know, that's why I put it up." I was like, oh. And then a few days later, he posted a status saying, "I'm on day 5 of the only water diet, and I need encouragement because I don't know if I can do this." And suddenly, he had more comments than he'd ever had before from all these women who were like dressed like cheerleaders in their photos, like these gorgeous women, and they were all like, "Oh, well done! You should do. Yeah, you can do it. Just keep on. You're so cool. You're so good. Yeah, you can." And I was just so fully engrossed in this guy's life. I was like, wow, he's a really sad person. He's really sad. He doesn't like how he looks. His mother tells him that he doesn't look that good. He's only ever encouraged by anyone. He only ever has friends when he says he wants to lose weight, and then suddenly everyone's his friend. You know, and this probably sounds like really bad. It sounds like I'm that guy from that Netflix show You, but I was just like, wow, this is so much bigger, you know, for us. And we don't, obviously, don't have time, and nor should we look up all the trolls, because that would take a lot of time and be very boring. But also, it's just like, wow, there's a whole person somewhere who somehow found my picture of me next to a text, like me in a bathing suit, me saying, "I look amazing, I love my body, I'm fat and happy." And then he's gotten really sad.
It's been
really
an explosion. It's been an explosion in him. Of all of the factors that has led to it.
Yeah, of course, fuck me. You know, of course, fuck you. Fuck you for being happy and fat and, you know, living your life. And, you know, when he's, like, according to his profile pictures, he's always in the dark, you know. And I kind of get it. And we're all just people. And then we just mistakenly take it out on each other instead of on the people whose fault it is, which is sort of my... Like, if there's one thing I want to say with the book, if there's one thing I want to say in general about body stuff, it's that we need to stop making it about us, because it's not about us. You know, it's not... We so want to blame each other. It's like we talk about trolls instead of talking about the platforms that allow trolls to keep abusing women. So we're always like, oh, how do we fix the trolls? The trolls are humans too. The trolls were... But Instagram, Facebook and Twitter allow them to exist, and we report it.
I have complained... I think more times than I can remember, and never has one single one of the tweets that they sent to me violated their code.
Yeah, not one.
Not a single one.
No.
And I've I do report them.
Yeah.
But I've never had a single complaint upheld.
Yeah.
No matter what it is that's been sent to me.
And then you get that condescending email from them saying, sometimes something is within a context.
Yeah.
You're like, oh,
I had one and it was
you.
A guy who was very homophobic, violent tweets. A string of them. And it didn't violate their Twitter code. So one of the things I think the body image is, it's a fascinating, it's a thing I struggle with. I've struggled with all my life. Because I think from a very early age, we're indoctrinated into the fact that it's important. So if you lose weight, it was the most difficult thing for me after Strictly. Because I lost weight. And everyone went, "Oh my God, you look so amazing, Susan. Oh my God, you look fantastic." And I was like, "Christ, what did you think I looked like before?"
Mm.
And the fact that everyone kept going on about how gorgeous I looked because I'd lost the weight, it wasn't a huge amount of weight, and it wasn't deliberate, it was just because I was dancing for 9 hours a day. It was really tough.
Yeah.
Because it played into every single one of my fears that because I was fat, no one liked me. And then I lost weight and everyone liked me. But from a very early age, in an office or at school, "Oh, you've lost weight, you look fantastic." It's what being thin is for a lot of people. I don't want to say everyone. For a lot of people, the most important thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there are surveys, there are studies. People would rather lose a limb. People would rather be blind. People would rather have painful acne. People would rather lose 10 years of their life. The studies shown that people fear it more than... And you can see, even when you talk... I did a TV thing where... The runner, we were walking to the dressing room, and she said, "Oh, I love your jumpsuit. Where'd you get it from?" And I was like, "Oh, ASOS." And she said, oh, I don't like ASOS. There are too many things. There's just too many pages of clothes. And I said, oh, you should try being fat because then there's only like two or three. And she went, no, oh, don't say that. No, don't say that about yourself. Like she was so, as if I'd said that I was going to start World War III. Like, don't, no.
Don't you say that about yourself. Don't say about yourself.
No. I was like, I mean, it doesn't matter how emotional you get. It doesn't matter how much you say, no, I'm still going to be a size 28. That's not going to change anything. Now you've just silenced it so that I can't talk about my experience, which is, oh, I actually find it really tough finding clothes anywhere. And you didn't know that was your privilege and you don't really want to acknowledge that. But actually do acknowledge that, you know, feel that discomfort that is, oh, wow, I have the opposite problem of what you have because you, you know, your body is so abhorrent that if you say the descriptive word that suits your body, I will shut you down and go, no. Like, wow, that is, imagine that, like just saying who you are, going, no, I'm a brunette. No, don't say that about yourself. You're blonde. You're like, I'm not though. Like, I have brown hair.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So
I've gone to photo shoots. I find it embarrassing. Sometimes me.
Photo shoots.
Well, you turn up. I did one. And I told them my size. And I was doing a photo shoot with two other women who were size six, size eight. And that's all they'd bought the clothes. So they're there having their photograph taken, having a lovely time.
Mm.
I've got a woman trying to put a bulldog clip at the back or sew me up or do something because I'm wearing the wrong clothes.
Yeah.
Because they haven't... And this happens all the time. I had a stylist. I had to get clothes for something. And they couldn't get my size because they don't lend plus size.
Mm.
So you can't get clothes for things. And it's embarrassing to stand while people are discussing how you look over there. Well, we just don't have the size. I mean, she's bigger than we thought. And you go, whew. And it's, I find it very difficult. The thing I find most difficult... Sorry, I'm using it as therapy.
That's okay.
I exercise 5 times a week. And people laugh when I say that. Because why am I fat? Because I should be thin.
Yeah.
And it's an extraordinary thing, the judgments that people make, isn't it?
Yeah, well, people so mistakenly think that you can look at someone and tell how they live their life. They think they can look at someone and go, right, so what you do is you eat pizza all day and you never exercise. And also you're probably unintelligent and asexual and, well, desexual. And you're miserable and you hate yourself and you want to be thin. And they just look at you and assume all of that. But
this is one of the most interesting things about what you do, which is saying you are happy the way that you are.
Mm.
Talk to me about that, because that's one of the things. It's extraordinary how angry people get when you say that you are happy the way that you are.
Well, there's Jess Baker, who's written two amazing books about this. She describes it as body currency. And it's this idea that we put so much effort and so much time and so much money into becoming thin or staying thin, right? So, I mean, I've I found 32 diet books in my mother's basement, right? Like, it was my entire life for 14 years. It was all I did was try to lose. When I was 8 years old, tried to lose weight. And it's just being hungry for 14 years, right? And so we do that, and we kind of have a subconscious or maybe conscious idea of how much we put into it. All because we want to be thin, and we think that thin equals happy, thin equals loved, success. I found a list I made when I was 12 about when I'm thin, I will be. And it was this list of 10 things. One of them was like, when I am thin, I can kiss a lesbian.
You can do that right now, Sophie. I'm not averse to that. You know I'm always
where
available.
Were you when I was, well, maybe not when I was 12. But
No, again, that's going slightly weird. Right, I'm offering it right now.
But I had all these ideas of like, I'll be able to wear trousers. I'll be able, my family will be proud of me. All these ideas that had nothing to do with size.
But you're putting a value on being thin, aren't you? You're
thin
putting
equals,
a value.
Yeah, yeah, good and happy and beautiful. Mm-hmm. So when someone comes in and goes, so you have an idea of how much money basically you've spent on trying to be thin. And it's a lot of money. It's one of the biggest industries in the world. So when someone comes in and goes, oh yeah, all that stuff that you're saving up for, that you're fighting for, that you're working hard for. Yeah, I got that for free. I'm actually really happy and I'm loved and I'm beautiful and I have sex and I'm kissing lesbians. Like, I'm doing great.
She certainly is right now. It's happening right now. I'm just professional enough to carry on podcasting while it's happening.
You're very talented.
I am very talented. I'm a designer. I'm an influencer. But people don't understand.
It's sort of like someone saying, you know, that whole savings you have, all those money, they're suddenly worthless. Like, that's the anger that people come with when you're like, actually, you don't have to be thin to be happy, because people have tried so hard to. The people who I get the worst amount of like bullying from online, harassment, are people who have like fitness profiles, people whose entire life is being into fitness.
But they also think, because I've seen this, because I remember I tweeted you once and you said, you said something like, don't tweet me about this because they'll come after you, because you've got a series of people that come after you. That they think you're promoting an unhealthy lifestyle, that you're dangerous because you're telling people.
Yeah.
And so much of it is about that. I think there was a story in the newspaper today, actually, about obesity is the biggest killer above anything else in the world ever. And so they personally target you for promoting what they think is an unhealthy lifestyle.
But that headline in that newspaper was also a headline in a newspaper in 1972. And then about 13 books and study, well, not 13 books was written, hundreds and hundreds of studies, hundreds of articles, think pieces, documentaries were created in order to kill this myth that obesity equals death. And they don't care, because it's not about that. No one actually cares about the fact, which is there is a correlation between fatness and higher mortality, but it's not that much. And also, it's not proven that that is the cause of it. There's a correlation between a lot of things, that people being taller people also die earlier. But is that because they're tall, or is that because of whatever other variety of reasons that could be? It is not about health. People do not have the same reaction to anyone else who's sick. No one has the same. I mean, I know smokers get a bit, but not at all as much. People who drink every weekend, people who do drugs, people who, all other sort of what you deem to be unhealthy behavior, they don't get that. It's because you hate fat people. It's because they hate fat people. That is the only reason. Because I have brought out, in my book, I have a whole health chapter, which I'm not the first one to write. There's loads of people who've done this before, of like, just, you know. Because then when you say to them, right, okay, let's imagine that fat is unhealthy. Let's imagine that's true. It's not, but let's imagine. Do you know what would help people feel better and not die? Is if you treated them really well, and you treated them with respect, and you stopped discriminating against them, and if you made sure they got proper health care and didn't have a doctor who said, well, you should just lose weight when you had like a sore finger, which is what happens. You know, most people with tumors in their stomach, if they're fat, they don't get discovered until it's too late, and then they die. Maybe that's why we keep dying, because you keep killing us. But if you say to them, like, you know what also a huge killer is stress, and you know what really causes stress? Discrimination. Then people just be like, well, fuck you, you're fat and disgusting. You're like, okay, so maybe you actually don't care about my health. Maybe you just don't want me to exist and be fat. That is the only reason people go on about health. People think they care, but they don't. Because, I mean, you can, as you say you go to the gym 5 times a week. There's loads of like famous yoga instructors who are fat. There's like a marathon runner who's fat. There's loads of marathon runners who are fat. There were, was it this year's London Marathon, where the fat runners got shouted at by some construction workers, or like the people, there were some people who were abusing the fat. Like, what do you want us to do then?
Yeah.
Oh, you should get healthy. Right, I'm going to go for a run. Fuck you, bitch. Okay, right, what do you want?
Because I go to the gym. I didn't go last night, and I already feel it. My mental health is for my mental health, because it's my 1 hour where I'm not. You know when I said I can never stop thinking. Mm. That's the only thing that stops me thinking, is hardcore horrific exercise that makes me want to vomit. It's the only thing that stops me thinking, and it gives me a break from my own head. Mm. For 55 minutes when I'm doing body combat and I'm pretending to punch someone I hate in the face. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because I find it not confusing, but I don't understand it. I hate online disputes now.
Mm.
I hate it. I can't function.
Mm.
I get an old-fashioned trigger warning if somebody has a go at me, because I have had it to a certain extent before and I cannot cope with it. Mm. It came creeping into my real life to such an extent that I am traumatised by it. What you do in talking about these things, writing the book about it, but also challenging online things that you see, how do you do that, Sophie? How do you function? As someone, you've admitted that you have mental health issues.
Yeah.
Which makes things difficult.
Yeah.
How the hell do you do this?
I was raised by my mother is very Danish. She's very rational. Everything was about logic. I've been raised to have a very realistic, objective, logic, rational view of the world, and a very strong sense of injustice. I staged a sit-in when I was 6 years old in my school because I just was against something the teacher had done, so I made everyone protest. Ever since I was six, I've been protesting and questioning authority. And my mom has, I said to her recently, I said, oh, thank you for always being on my side when you were called to the principal's office because I'd done something, staged a protest. And she said, well, of course, I wouldn't want to raise you to respect authority. So that's pretty much my upbringing. It's this very, like, fight the system, fight the system. So when I realized when I was 21 that it's the system that makes us hate our bodies, it's not a fact, everything clicked into place and I felt like fighting it. And so I have this very, I mean, my grandfather is a psychopath. And I believe there is a part of me there's a place inside of me that I can go when I need to, that has an air of that, which is a scary thing to say, and it's not something I'm proud of, but it's something that I think I've had to do in order to survive. So when it comes to right or wrong, that's also factually wrong, but also morally wrong, I can sort of turn off a lot of the discomfort and be like, if someone says you're fat online, well, I am, so what? If they say you're not funny, I can be like, well, I am, so you're wrong. So this doesn't bother me. It's the same with reviews to a certain extent. Of course, I can get a bit like emotional about reviews, but in general, if their review is true, objectively true, like, oh, the middle bit was lacking, I can look at the show objectively and go, oh, it is actually. I hadn't seen that before now. That is true, so the 3-star review is fair. Or if it's unfair, I can be like, well, then it doesn't apply to me because it's wrong. What they're saying is wrong. And I put that same thing into the trolls where I go, well, they're either wrong or they're right. And so far, none of them have said anything right. That's because they're not intelligent. You know, they couldn't figure out exactly what to say to nail. like there was someone in my tour show who said that I was wrong about a fact I'd said about Westlife. And I got genuinely offended. And I was like, wow. Yeah. Excuse me. I was like, well, that's the first time I've been really annoyed by something.
Of course I know about Westlife, right?
And I was like, they were born in this on the 1970s.
I mean, this is the thing, and I'm going to be quite brutally honest just now. I've had many comedians on this podcast who've talked about how great comedy is and we're so glad we're doing comedy and it saved their life and it was amazing. The comedy industry, though...
The disdain in your voice.
The comedy... Being honest about the comedy industry, let's not pretend it's some form of halcyon land of rainbows lollipops. You know, you just need to look at... Using an example that everyone knows about so we don't get into trouble, Louis C.K., and his behaviour... Mm-hmm. If you don't know about it, I would suggest you Google it. He admitted I'm going to say sexual acts, because that's what we're doing on the BBC News, in front of women, often whether they liked it or not, yeah. I think. He would ask their permission but not really care about it.
Yeah.
And after a brief stint away, he's come back and is doing shows and moaning about how much work he's lost because of it.
Yeah.
So the misogyny in the comedy industry is something which I... is there.
Yeah.
So I'd be quite interested just to talk to you about that, that we're seeing it is a better industry than some for us. But let's face it, there are still issues.
I love comedy, you know, like comedy. I love jokes. I love shows. I love performing. I love comedians, the ones I like. I like their comedians.
The ones I like are nice. The ones I don't like are bastards.
But I feel home with comedians. I feel it's actually... only in the past couple of years I felt like comedy isn't that much of a home anymore, because now there are outright right-wing comedians who are proudly right-wing comedians who do very, very damaging material. Comedians have always done damaging material. We just, a lot of us just didn't really know that it was damaging, and now we've all learned and we've been like, oh, yeah, I don't make those jokes anymore. Good. But then they've, you know, they've doing their free speech gigs and and they're doing all these YouTube videos which are just so hateful about all the marginalized groups of people. And I feel like I was flipping through the reading through the Edinburgh Fringe brochure, and there were like shows that were just like describing themselves as like free speech, I'm a white guy and that's okay kind of thing. And I think that is so scary and so sad, because I'm like, comedy's not for you. Comedy's not for you. That's not what this is. Comedy's about sharing and about being vulnerable and about saying the things that actually needs to be said. And no one needs to say that it's not okay to be gay or whatever, not okay to be fat. So I think the more I've become aware of, I guess, socio-political stuff, the more I'm aware of, and not just being aware of what's right and wrong, but also what's... like how, what the damage of that is. Like there was a person who came up to me after my gig 2 years ago in Edinburgh, and she said, I needed to laugh because I went to see this other show. And she mentioned this show that year was huge. Everyone was talking about it, praising the show. And she said the comedian did a sarcastic anti-gay joke, a homophobic joke. Mm. And she said I was the only one in the audience who looked visibly queer, and everyone stared at her when he made this sarcastic, ironic, homophobic joke. And then she said, as I was leaving, two guys in the audience called me a homophobic slur, but not in any ironic way. And I saw that show, and he did the same about fat people, and I was just like, this is so painful, because he's still being praised as a liberal comedian, like a good left-wing comedian. But this has actual physical damage. This is actually damaging. I've seen comedians who are also doctors doing anti-fat jokes about their fat patients, which is directly responsible for me postponing doctor visits, because I don't know what they're going to think. What are the odds I'm going to go in and like get half naked and complain about something, and now I've heard someone say on stage what they might be thinking, and that's it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I went to see a show at the Fringe. A few years ago, and I always watch comedy in a way that comedians watch comedy, because we go, yeah. I'm not engaged. Mm. I am engaged, but I'm engaged in a different level. So the comedian on stage made a fat joke, and there were three women in front of me. They were similar size, larger than me, whatever, laughing away. And I wanted to go, it's you. He's laughing at you. You do know that, don't you? He's just made a joke about you. A hideous joke about you. And me, I went because my wife said we had to go because she wanted to see what it was like. And the difficulty is I stopped doing club gigs for a couple of reasons. First of all, Jeremy Hardy told me to stop because I wasn't enjoying it. And he said, well, stop doing it.
Yeah.
And it was because I was comping a night at a comedy club. And a compere, if you don't know, if you're listening to this, has to be relentlessly cheerful, really.
Yeah.
We're the ones that go, hey, and next up. And if someone dies, you bring the audience up. And I, there were racist homophobics. And I thought, I can't go on stage after this.
Yeah.
And go, wasn't he amazing?
Yeah.
And I thought, I can't do it. It's traumatic for me. And then to sit backstage with people arguing that Section 28 never damaged anyone in this country because they didn't know any gay people. And the Daily Mail suggesting that we're all liberal snowflakes, it's wrong. It's actually wrong. Our community has a similar amount of racist, homophobes, trans, you know, whatever you want. And actually the Fringe is an interesting time because it kind of bubbles to the surface, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It's so... I find with fat jokes, the worst thing, and it only occurred to me recently why it was so bad, the people who do fat jokes, they never say you. They say they.
Yeah.
You know how fat people, they. And that's worse. If they had just had the fucking balls to say you, even if it's abusive, whatever, they can't even say you. They're not even assuming you're there.
Uh-huh.
And that, I'm like... You know, because you hear sexist jokes where they go, oh, you women, you're like this, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is still
bad. Oh,
that's
really interesting in the pronoun, isn't it?
It's still bad, but if they said the women they are, like the feeling you would then have in your body of like, wait, am I not even in the fucking room? I had to follow a comedian who did a something about the Olympics. Like, oh, there's apparently fat people in the Olympics. what are they competing in? Pie eating contest? Something like that. And then I was on next. So it was like, yeah, what is this, Sophie? And I saw like this room, 400 people, and I saw like at least four fat women, or people who, fat people. And then you have that, you know, the whole room had exploded with laughter at this, right? So what do you do? Do you go, oh, hey, just do my regular jokes? Because you've just laughed at me. The whole room has just laughed at my existence. So what do? Do I play to the four fat people and kind of go, hey, we're okay, and then die on my ass and do a bad job? Or do I... And I did. That's what I did. I just went, like, did, like, an old joke where I basically ended up calling him a cunt. And, of course, the room didn't laugh because they just accepted his premise that, oh, it is embarrassing and horrible to be fat, so why is this funny? And then he later DM'd me and said if I could plug his Soho run because he wasn't selling tickets, and I went... Well, I can't because all of, you know, my followers are people who don't think it's a joke to be fat.
Yeah.
So I would be lying if I sent them to go and see your show and then they would hear jokes like that. So no, I can't pluck your show.
I did something once. My first headline set. So I had to sit through everyone else's stuff. And the comedian before me was a gentleman who made a number of jokes about shagging a fat bird. And she was gagging for it because she was so fat. She was just delighted to have sex with anyone.
Yeah.
Now, I think I'd had a couple of drinks, Sophie, by that point. I don't really drink anymore, but I did drink at that point. And the audience were loving it. They were loving it. And I was like, oh, I don't know what's happening. Okay, right, okay. So I went on stage for the headline set and told a story about, I think it was fingering a fat bird beside a skip while she was eating chips. And she was loving it and she was, you know. And there was complete silence in the audience. And I was like, what's wrong? You were loving it earlier on. Is there something making you uncomfortable here?
That's amazing.
Because I was like, I hated that audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
For laughing at that.
Yeah.
And then when I went on and did it, because I wasn't a bloke talking about it, they all went, oh, that's horrific. And I was like, what? Sorry, I don't understand. Something changed.
Yeah.
Because earlier on, that was hilarious to you. So it was quite a short headline set, I'll be honest with you. But I was so angry at them laughing at that. And then I was going to go on after as if nothing has happened.
Yeah, and just be like,
as if
do your self-deprecating.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I also know I'm fat.
And I'm such a short, Scottish woman. And actually, that was quite an interesting change in my psyche of, hang on a second. And it's... It's one of the most difficult reasons why... It's one of the reasons I don't do stand-up anymore, Sophie, because people think I'm that nice lady from the telly.
Mm.
And actually, in stand-up terms, I'm a very angry woman.
Mm.
I'm very angry about everything.
Yeah.
And I worry that the audience will get a fright when they come and see the nice lady from the telly and actually all I'm doing is shouting about things because I feel so angry.
I kind of want them to
Feel uncomfortable?
I have sort of, not the same, but a lot of my audience assume that I'm really nice. I'm not nice, I just have fat cheeks, I look nice. Like, it's not the same thing.
It's one of those things, like, do you know, it's because I'm so short, people think I'm adorable. People ruffle my hair.
Yeah,
and
they
think, they hug me like I'm a toddler. God. Well, you're so sweet, you're so sweet, aren't you? And it just makes me want to kill them.
But I think the difference between us and our situation is that you are playing to people who don't already know. Like, I'm playing very much to people who know what I'm going to be saying. It's an echo chamber that other people would say that's a criticism. Whereas I say it as, a lot of the people I do comedy for don't have
They don't have any other safe spaces, though.
It's never a safe space. I'm very scared of saying safe space because there's no such thing as safe spaces. It can be very damaging for people to assume.
That's absolutely right. Because anything could be a difficulty.
And I don't want people to let their guards down because...
What you do try and do, though, to be fair...
I'm trying to make it so that people who usually don't have a... who usually wouldn't go and see comedy or who usually wouldn't be included in most things, I'm trying to make it as inclusive as I can. But that's not to say... Which is sort of... So I had a whole tour that was anxiety safe, meaning they could message me if they had an anxiety, like, I need to get into the room before everyone else, or do you say the word banana, or anything like that. They could email me and I could answer them. I made sure every venue had gender-neutral toilets and was wheelchair accessible. But that means... And it was great. It worked really well. It was very good. But that means that now... And also I had a trigger warning for that show. But that was only because... The show started with me saying, so my grandfather was emotionally abusive. So, you know, it didn't matter that that they knew that already, because that was the first line. Where my other two shows were about anxiety and depression, I didn't have a trigger warning because I wouldn't talk about that till 2/3 of the way into the show. So the fear is now I'm doing a new show. There's no trigger warning. Not as in there shouldn't be one, but I don't use it. I also can't promise that every venue is wheelchair accessible, has gender-neutral toilets.
Yep.
I can just make sure that I've definitely asked and hope that they've said yes, and if not, you know.
Yeah.
So the fear is that people come to my shows now expecting it to be a safe space or expecting it to be have gender-neutral toilets or expect, you know, I had someone ask me if I had told the venue staff in Edinburgh to not assume anyone's gender, and I was like, no, I haven't. I mean, I can try, but... It's the fringe, and it's going to be new people every day, and I can't promise you that someone won't fuck up.
Yeah.
I can't promise you that I won't fuck up. You know, I did a Q&A in my last tour, my book tour, and I would sometimes, because you're on stage and your mind is racing and you're having to think of 17 different things, like, what's the time? Have you answered that question before? What? And then you'll point to someone and say, yeah, what's your question? Yeah, the woman in blue.
Yes, I know. Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's just because we're human and we, you know... So I really don't want people to think that from now on going to my gigs is just going to make them feel really, really good all the time.
Because it won't necessarily.
No, I can't promise, but I can promise I'll try. I just want to say, because I had a BBC host presenter thing a few weeks ago say, but it doesn't sound like you're trying to be that inclusive towards like right-wing people. I don't think they could come to your shows and feel safe. I was like, yeah, no, they can't. They absolutely cannot. They can absolutely fuck off. I do not give a shit.
I always give my guests the final statement. Anything you want to say. Anything
at all.
Oh,
my God.
Anything you want to say about anything. Anything at all. Whatever's on your mind just now. It's a snapshot in time, a podcast.
Okay. What's on my mind a lot is... I'm very tired of politics, and what I'm tired of, I'm very tired of talking to other left-wing, activist-y, socialist, people with, you know, who are, and it's not my word to use, like woke, in lack of better word, people about how right we are and how factually correct all of our opinions are and how wrong the right wing are and how much they're lying. And because that has been the discourse for 4 years now, hasn't it, of... But he lied. There were not that many people at the inauguration. And then we feel really clever and we feel like we've won because we're like pointing out all the facts. I'm doing it with my activism, with fat doesn't equal cancer. Fat doesn't mean that you're unhealthy and boom. And also, all people are equal and everyone should have equal rights. And discrimination kills and actually immigration can be good and blah, blah, blah. And we just go in circles and circles going, we're right, but we're right. And we are. We're factually correct. Everything that we believe in is based on facts and it's based on science. and it's the truth. And then we somehow keep trying to fight the right with truth, and they have never given a fuck. It's never been about facts. It's been about just opinions and feelings.
Yeah.
It's just them saying, well, there were that many people at the inauguration, and then all of his supporters go, mm-hmm, yeah. And then that's just it.
And they just ignore it. It's like my 7-year-old niece.
Yeah.
You can say something to her and she go, yeah, sure. And then she just walks on. It's like, no, I just had a conversation with you about something.
I am right. I am right about this. I am right. And we can't keep saying, but we are right, but this is fact, and da-da-da, because it's not working. We're trying to use our empathy. We're trying to use our intelligence, and that won't work on them because they're neither of those things. So if we have to actually fight them, we can't just sit and talk to each other about how right we are and how clever we are and how all the statistics are on our side, because by the time we've patted ourselves on the back for being so right about everything, they've started World War III. So we need another way to beat them. And so far what we've been doing by being really nice and being really clever and being civil has not been working. So I think my final statement is punch Nazis.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, my God. Oh, my dear God in heaven. I mean, that's the trailer, Ben.
Yeah, you can't edit that out.
That's the trailer.
Yeah.
Sophie, I know you. If people don't know you, tell me. I don't know why I'm doing this like a sexy voice. I don't know why I'm doing it like, oh, carry on. Sophie,
yes.
How can people find out more about you? Where should they go to?
I'm so happy you asked, Susan. I think Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. So being with an F, S O F I E H A G E N.
S O F I E H A G E N.
Yeah, but I think the main thing is signing up for my newsletter, because that's where I won't be silenced.
I will not be silenced. But this newsletter is coming out no matter what happens.
But people listening will be into podcasts, and that's like one of my main big
loves.
Oh, yes,
you've got Made of Human.
So I've Made of Human, a conversational podcast. You should definitely listen. People listening will like you, so if you listen to your episode of it, because it's...
No, you never know.
Not anymore, not after
Maybe
this episode.
Maybe people are just sitting there. I imagine people sometimes who don't like me sitting like in a bath full of salt, just scrubbing themselves so it's extra painful. I hate Susan. You know what I mean? Just for extra.
But then you'll absolutely love that I have so many hours of you on my podcast.
It's
an extra
hours,
long show.
Yes.
And then I have a new podcast called Secret Dinosaur Cult.
Which is great.
Have you heard it?
Of course
I have.
Oh
my God, thank you. I love it. It's a live comedy podcast about daddy issues and trauma and queer stuff and non-binary stuff and dinosaurs.
I mean, Sophie, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you so much for
having
me.
That's me snapping into Kirsty Wark. Sophie, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much.
No, that's Lynaine Kelly.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, no, thank you.
You can just edit that in whenever you've said,
Thank you for having me as we kissed. As we kissed in a podcast studio.
My
in
lesbian
the basement
dream come true.
Of TV Centre. Thank you very much, Sophie Hagen. Thank you for listening to Mrs. Brightside. If you like the show, why not subscribe? We're available everywhere you can download podcasts. And if you've already subscribed, why not tell a friend? Next week, I'll be talking to Scotty.
I am literally making this up. I got expelled from school when I was 14, never went back to education, never went to university, have blagged my way into this room to have a chat with you.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's like an audience with a queen, I'll be very honest with you. A lot of people have tried to get into this room and have failed.
I mean, many a time people meet me have said it's an audience with a queen.
Yeah.
But
Susan Kalman's Mrs. Brightside is hosted, appropriately enough, by me, Susan Kalman. The producer is Benjamin Sutton and is a BBC Studios production for Acast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.